Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Dave Kirpin. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for asking. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And I have to repeat what I said before we recorded. I was just before we hit record, like 10 minutes ago, reading my own book. And when I'm reading my own book, I don't usually look at footnotes. And then I looked at the footnote, and it happened to be an article that your wife wrote about a leadership student of mine at NYU for Forbes. And I was like, what are the odds? Like 10 minutes before I talk to you.
Amazing, amazing small world, and a reminder of how interconnected we all are.
Yeah, I think we met because we both wrote at Inc. I don't know if you still write there. I don't write there anymore, but do you?
I do occasionally, less frequently than I used to, yeah.
But you've written a book, Get Over Yourself, How to Lead and Delegate Effectively for More Time, More Freedom, and More Success. And I have to say that while reading it, I kept thinking that the title's really great because it has multiple meanings.
That's right.
Like get over yourself, get past yourself, and then get over above yourself. And I presume that was part of what you were thinking of.
Yeah, that's right. It's about leading and delegation and sort of getting work off of your plate. But it's really about the mental and psychological roadblocks that keep us from delegating. And that's what the dual meaning of get over yourself is all about.
Yeah. When I was reading it, I felt like at the beginning, I'm thinking, oh, this is about fear. This is about trust, which I think came off in the first page. And then you get into it later. It's about fear and anxiety. But I've jumped into it because I found it valuable. Because, you know, people are joining my team and I'm scared of delegating and I want to delegate. But let's go back a step. And can you give us some background on how you came to write a book on delegation, leadership? And if you don't mind sharing about earlier books on likability.
Yeah. So this is my fourth business book and fifth book overall. But that being said, I'm really an entrepreneur. I think of myself as an entrepreneur. And so when I write books, I'm really looking to solve problems the same reason I build companies. And, you know, I wrote my first book, Likeable Social Media, was about helping folks manage the, you know, then very new and certainly then and still fast changing world of social media. And then I realized that a lot of those same principles of likable social media, listening and transparency and authenticity applied not only to social media, but to entrepreneurship. So I wrote Likeable Business about that. And then with The Art of People, I extended that concept to people skills in general and just building relationships with people. And this book came about because in working with my latest company, Apprentice, which connects entrepreneurs and small business owners with college students that work for them, I realized that what holds a lot of entrepreneurs and small business owners back is their inability to delegate well, either their refusal to delegate or they delegate and then micromanage. And so I wrote Get Over Yourself because I think that a lot of people go through life without being able to be good at this skill. And not only does it hold them back in terms of their businesses and inability to scale, but more important, it keeps them from being able to prioritize the most important things to them, right? I've had people come to me and say, you know, if I had only delegated more, I would have had more time with my kids, or, you know, I wish I had had more time to travel, or all these regrets that folks have. And my hope with this book is to help people get to a place where they can prioritize their time a little bit better and yes, build those companies and build their teams and build their businesses, but also build their lives in a way that's meaningful for them.
And before we get into the content of what you just said, I have to comment on the tone because I think anyone who's an entrepreneur knows entrepreneurship means passion. I mean, I'm hearing that you're passionate about helping people and that the books are to help your consulting with people and the consulting is probably leads to the books. And several times in your book, you're like, contact me. I think on Fridays, is this bad for me to share or is it great for me to share?
No, Thursdays. Yeah, I do pro bono office hours every Thursday. And it's funny because for the launch of this book, I reached out to folks that I've worked with on Thursdays and I did like a mail merge with my Calendly. And I was very proud and frankly, a little surprised that I had worked with 835 people in my pro bono office hours. So yeah, no, I only do it on Thursday afternoons, but I get a kick out of helping people. So yeah, schedule.dave.com is the link for that sign up.
And even with all that, it's funny because I wrote in my notes, book is about fear, trust, control. And then I wrote also time with family, freedom, living deliberately. And when you said priorities, I think it's easy to think logistics and operational stuff seems low level, but you need that low level stuff. If you don't have that down, it's easy to think, oh, I got the high level stuff down, so the low level will work itself out. But really, that's often not the case. And it's easy to lose sight of what it's really for. I mean, what's the money for?
That's right. I think that both are important. And a lot of people think, okay, well, I can figure out the systems to delegate, but then fear and trust issues hold them back. Or people can tackle the fear and trust issues, but they don't necessarily have all the systems and tools in place to have a smooth running operation. And so, yeah, ultimately, Josh, I think it's about having both.
Now, is that too good to be true? Do you have to get one to get the other? How does that work?
Well, I think the first stuff, the mental stuff is frankly most important. Although, you know, I had a therapist that helped me kind of act first. Sometimes you set up all the systems and it forces you to get over the fear and the trust stuff. So for those that are really struggling, right, I have one story I tell in the book about somebody whose wife was basically going to leave him if they didn't take a vacation. And because he had been focusing so much on his business that he hadn't taken a vacation in 10 years. And he didn't think he could do it, but he sort of felt like he had no choice. So ultimately, he took the vacation, he delegated the work, and guess what? The business didn't fall apart. So sometimes I think we sort of have to force our way through. But yeah, in an ideal world, I think we tackle our psychological issues, we tackle our fear and trust issues, and then once we tackle them, we can get on with the systems and tools.
There wasn't quite a story, maybe a vignette in the book that I found really valuable. It was Kelly Flynn and talking about mindsets. Because a lot of listeners know that I talk about like the Spodek method is a mindset shift followed by continual improvement. And if your mindset is backward, if your mindset isn't aligned with your goals, you don't even realize what's going on, that you may be sabotaging yourself. Something I say a lot. And changing it. Can you share? I'd love to hear a bit more about the story if you know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, Kelly is wonderful. She's my longtime therapist, and I was delighted to give her a shout out in the book. And yeah, I mean, Kelly helped me kind of get over myself when I was really struggling with making a difficult decision about a partner. And I think, you know, as I tell the story in the book, it's like sometimes we just have to act. And by acting, by doing even what we're perhaps most afraid of, and by taking action in a way that does align, to your point, with our goals and with our values, then the rest will work itself out. And we will sort of get to a place where we are more comfortable, even when we were terrified, when we're more comfortable. I did that in business, and I also did that in my personal life. I don't know if I told the story of the dog in the book, but you know, I was afraid of dogs my whole life, and my family really, really wanted a dog, and I just acted as if and acted with the values of supporting my family and got a dog, and I got over my fear. I just forced my way through it. So sometimes when we act in conjunction with our goals and values, we can skip over that first part, that fear part, and ultimately act as if, and the fear will work itself out.
Yeah, when you say it, I think to myself, of course, and I think of the times when I've acted, I guess I would think, fake it till you make it, but the phrase, I don't have your book in front of me right now, oops, I should, but it said, it's easier to act your way into thinking differently than thinking your way into acting differently, something like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. And yeah, the reason I don't like the words fake until you make it is it implies a lack of authenticity with the word fake. Mm-hmm. And I think authenticity is really important, but we're being true to the way I think about it is, instead of being true to our emotions in the moment, we're being true to our values. And so in the example that I just shared about the dog, yes, I was very afraid of having a dog, but I valued what was meaningful to my family. And I valued that over, in this case, my fear. And so I took the action that I knew would ultimately help to solve for the fear. And yeah, and it worked. So I think for many of us, like fear is okay. Like we're basically all afraid of stuff. So sometimes we have to say to ourselves, well, yes, I'm afraid of this, but I also have these goals and I have these values. And if I focus on the actions that it's going to take to meet those goals and to meet those values, then maybe I can have the courage to act in the face of my fear.
Yeah, when I hear you say it, I think of all the times when I have done that. Then when the next time that something drives, makes me feel fear of doing something, like of delegating something that I know that I'm the best person to do it, but I got too many things and it's not going to get done otherwise. But then I don't know how many times I still choke. I still, not choke, get choked up. You know, fear, let the fear drive my behavior. Even though I know, even though I've had the experience, it still overrides me.
Yeah. So the challenge is that any small task, in the moment, it might feel like it is easier to get to do it ourselves. And, you know, the act of finding someone and explaining how to do it and all of that, it feels like it's a lot harder than just doing it ourselves. And frankly, that's probably true for that one individual task. But it's the grand sum of task after task and project after project and years later and hours and hours and hours later, how much time have we spent doing all of those tasks when had we found somebody that can do 100 tasks and written out the instructions for how to do those commonly done tasks and then ultimately empowered somebody to do that work for us, in the long run, of course, it'll save us massive amount of time and massive amount of mental energy and allow us to focus on the bigger priorities for us in our business and our lives. But in that moment, we're not thinking that. We're thinking, oh, do I really have to explain this to someone? Let me just do it myself. But it's the collection of those moments, Josh, that ultimately can be our downfall.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to make myself be aware. I mean, it's so easy when I see it in others. And it's so, what's the word, like slippery? Or it's easy to just react before thinking. When there are these emotions that you kind of, like if I feel helpless, it's rare that I'm like, I feel helpless. Look at me. Isn't that great? So I kind of want to hide it even from myself.
Right.
That's it.
Right. Well, what I recommend in the book and around this particular topic is really just taking a couple weeks to do an inventory of all those tasks. As you do all those things, write them down and just make a note. Don't try to change any of your behavior. Just make notes and then look back and you can kind of get a list. Okay, well, this is how I spent my time. These were all the tasks and projects and activities. And okay, of all of that, what could I in fact delegate and how would I do that? And then it's that self-awareness that allows us to proceed.
Yeah, that self-awareness drawn. So sorry, you got me thinking now of systematizing, making a process that exposes it, whether I want to or not.
Yeah, it's scary, but ultimately it's that self-awareness that will allow us. And then to your point about feelings, look, I mean, I'm not a therapist and I don't need everyone to be, you know, sort of walking around getting in touch with all their emotions. But, you know, when along with that inventory of tasks, of course, when the feeling is self-evident, yeah, you might also jot down, hey, feeling kind of anxious about this, feeling kind of overwhelmed, feeling kind of stressed or whatever that feeling is when it's within reach again. And ultimately, if we act as if the feelings end up working themselves out, right? If we know we need to delegate X, Y, and Z, and we can either tackle our fears or just do it and then it'll work itself out. Like I said, like with my dog.
I hope you don't mind that I indulge myself in asking questions that are specifically relevant to me. Although it seems like listeners seem to like when I ask stuff that's more specific and not just the broad stuff.
No, it's perfect. It's perfect. Feel free to give an example. We can workshop really right now if you want things that you could potentially delegate and to whom.
Well, then, all right, let's come back to that one second. I did want to ask, because the book has only been out a little while, I think a week now.
Yeah.
And yeah, as we record a little bit later and when it posts, and have you had enough time for people to get, or maybe they were early readers. Did you get, are there stories of people who read the book and has there been enough time to get feedback from them?
Yeah, it's been really, really nice because I've been very focused on marketing and promotion. And it's very easy in that marketing and promotion to get lost, to lose sight of the message and the purpose. And so getting some feedback from a few early readers has been really meaningful and wonderful. And I, you know, so far people have found it valuable, and that's why I do what I do. So it's been really, really nice. And it's funny, I wrote this book as a business book, and only during the marketing and promotion of it did I realize that the principles probably apply to parents in terms of delegating work around the house and delegating chores to our kids. And so I wrote a bonus chapter that was too late to get in the book, but that I posted on my website, and I've gotten some good feedback on that too from folks that are like, wow, this is actually really helpful to get our kids to do more work around the house.
I'm going to guess not just do it, but enjoy it.
Well, you know, look, the word chore is not a fun word. It's not a fun word. But yes, of course, elements of successful delegation of household work include making it fun and bringing as much excitement to the process as possible. You know, we pump up Taylor Swift songs in our house when they're setting the table and clearing the table, for example.
You reminded me of seeing my sister and her three kids at one time. It was pre-Taylor Swift. It was Call Me Maybe, I think, was a song, Carly Rae Jepsen. And they were all singing and dancing around while doing chores.
Nice. Nice. Yes, the perfect example, if a bit timed out, nonetheless, perfect example.
Okay. Now, the reason I paused there, because here's something I was thinking of, because you write about all your different businesses. And so Apprentice, you help college students and business people connect so that the college students, I mean, I guess the guy who started it, the Hamilton student, said, I learned more from working with you than I did in 4 years in college. And I work on sustainability leadership, and I know that a lot of college students are, I mean, it's much a bigger issue for them because they got more of their lives to deal with this mess. And I'm thinking, I bet they would love working on what I'm working on. And I'm also thinking, yeah, but I don't have time because our college students, they don't quite get it yet. But maybe there's a big connection there. And maybe my fear is holding me back because of there have been times when I've been burned when college, this happens all the time. This happened with every semester at NYU. Some student would come up to me afterward and say, I love what you're doing. Can I work with you? And eventually I'd learn to say, like, check your schedule, because it's worse for me if you start and then stop in the middle than if you don't start at all. And they'd say, oh, yeah, I can, no problem, I can do it. And then they would, at some point in the middle, they'd say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And if I asked, then I would find out that there was something they really could have told beforehand. And so I got burned. Yep. And so I feel fear. It's exactly what I was talking about.
Yep. So let me talk about the getting burned and the fear part, because I do think that's important. And then I'll share my experience with college students in general and why and how it works for me so well. Look, we do get burned and in relationships and in life. And when it happens, it makes it hard. And yet we have to keep going in certain instances. So the example I use, right, is dating, and relationship doesn't work out and it makes it harder to date for a little while. But eventually we figure it out and we move forward and we go forward again until hopefully, you know, we meet the one and we're married and hopefully it works out from there. Sometimes it doesn't and folks have to start again. It's really hard to start again after we're burned in a marriage, but nevertheless, people do. So back to you, you were burned by a couple college students. Does that mean that college students can never work for you? No. Is it hard though, given that you were burned a couple times? Yes. And the first step is recognizing that and sort of saying, well, I can either try again or not. You know, unlike the sort of relationships and marriage example, you probably don't have as much at stake to try again. But that being said, I'll share, Josh, you know, in my experience, and the reason we started Apprentice was college students have been massively, massively valuable to me in building up my previous businesses. At one point in our first business, the marketing agency Likeable that we sold a few years ago, we had 60 college students working for us and just like 10 or 12 full-time employees at the time. Massively valuable. I had to build a set of criteria, including availability, to your point. I also had to recognize how quickly things changed for the college students, including availability. So at first, you know, I would hire a student and expect them to work for me for the rest of their time in school. And sometimes that works out, and that's wonderful when it does. But that's no longer my expectation now. My expectation is I get the most out of the college student that works for me for 3 to 6 months, and then I understand that their schedule may change. They may study abroad. That, you know, things just change more rapidly for them. But that's okay, because if I find the right person that's really committed and eager and curious and wants to learn and wants to teach, because by the way, bidirectional mentorship is a core value of mine, and students absolutely have things to teach me and our apprentice clients as well. If I can find those people, they've been massively valuable to me for a lot and a lot less than I would have to pay a full-time employee. And that's really how Apprentice came about and why we've been so successful in terms of bringing college students to entrepreneurs and small business owners.
Now, I have a 501c3. Right now, there's a core team of deeply passionate people, but we're not making money right now. Is that a problem?
Well, in a nutshell, yes. I mean, a 501c3 doesn't ever need to make money per se, but obviously you need revenues to fund your operations, to fund the work that you're looking to do. And so I think that's where thinking through how you do that and how you can bring in additional people to help you do that, of course, becomes important. And not enough 501c3s think entrepreneurially. But my favorite example of one that does is Charity Water. Scott Harrison has done a wonderful job of building a really massively large nonprofit using entrepreneurial and digital marketing driven methods, for one.
I guess I should have said not now, before. There's this big, the pre and post the book. So the book launch is when everything starts, but the book launch will be this year. But it's, I guess it would be, or would students be interested in working before that launch or only afterward? And there's fundraising. Or is that too detailed a question for now?
Well, only you would know much better than I, but I find that one of the reasons I love working with students is it's sort of like this blank slate and they have lots of interests. And so it's really a matter of finding the right, you know, many students would not be interested, but you don't need many students. You need maybe two who are super interested and passionate and dedicated to the work that the 501c3 is doing and will do. And I think, I'm a big fan of the model. I think that a lot of what keeps people from delegating is this limiting belief that they don't have the resources or the opportunity. Folks are like, I don't have the money to pay people, or I don't have the access to people. But I do think that it's just that. It's a limiting belief. And when we look hard at the facts, we can find people, whether it's finding partners for our businesses or college students or folks on Upwork that are working from foreign countries for $5, you know. There are almost always opportunities to find great talent that's interested in working for us.
All right. So I should go to Apprentice and I guess put up what I haven't been there. What is it too far afield? I was going to say, is it too far afield from Delegate? But you keep bringing it back to delegating. And if it's not too far afield from the current book, do I just go to your page and just get started? Or do I prepare beforehand?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to do a sales pitch for Apprentice, but I'll say that the website is chooseapprentice.com, and folks can learn more about how to tap into our talent. And we focus on operations, marketing, business development, data analytics. So if any of those areas are valuable to your 501c3, then sure, check out the website.
Well, I appreciate you indulging me on my selfish isn't the right word because, you know, there's a mission here. It's not just for me, but I appreciate that. And I see why you connect everything that you do, because they're all connected, which I think is part of what you're about. I mean, you say at the beginning of how your life is how you want it to be in terms of spending time with the kids, with the family, not working too many hours. And I think also your book is for successful people. It's not for people who are failing. It's people, I mean, you talk about people making 6-7 figures a year and they got these great businesses. And yet there's this thing that they're not noticing, that they're not good at, and they get caught in that cycle. It's for successful people to become yet more successful in areas that they might have been missing.
Yet more successful and also self-aware enough to be able to prioritize their time and goals and make that time for themselves and whatever those goals are, right? So for many people, it's their kids. For others, it might be a certain mission, right? For others, it might be, you know, pursuing certain passions, writing their own books. I mean, there's so many things that people want to do with their time that they end up not doing in many cases because their time is controlled by others or controlled by a limiting belief that they need to spend it working on X, Y, or Z. And so the point of this book is, are you self-aware? Are there things that you could be spending with your time that you would rather be doing? And if so, how can you better delegate and prioritize to make sure that you get through that and you're not sitting on your deathbed, you know, thinking, wow, I wish I had had the time to fill in the blank. That's the goal. It really is. And for me, you know, even if I didn't sell any books or sell another, you know, apprentice, a program, just knowing that I feel very, very grateful that my wife and I have been able to build a life where we are able to prioritize that time for each other and for our children and for pursuing our interests. It's a wonderful, wonderful gift. And we've worked hard and we've also had, you know, of course, lots of luck come our way, but it's a wonderful gift. And I want for others to have those same opportunities.
Well, that described it very well. And with that, I'm going to transition to what we talked about before. And Dave was a little, he was like, Dave is why I bring leaders on the show, because he was like, Josh, I don't really think about this stuff much, about sustainability. And I said, listeners really like that. I'm going to jump into the Spodek method, if that's cool with you.
Yes, please.
Is the environment something that matters to you enough to have acted on it in any way?
Yes.
When you think about the environment, when you think about nature, it's different for everyone because, you know, we've all had different experiences, especially our formative experiences. You know, some people grow up by the beach, some people grow up by the mountains. When you think of nature, are there any quintessential moments of yourself where you've been in nature, you know, you're not polluting, you're far away from things, maybe formative experience? Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, well, I was a city boy. I grew up in Brooklyn. I spent very little time, I would say, really exploring nature. But that said, I had a couple summers that I spent in Southampton, and I have some formative memories when I was, 8 and 9 of jumping waves in the ocean and without a care in the world and thinking, you know, about and thinking back about the beauty and peacefulness of those experiences.
What, jumping waves, is that like, oh, I guess you're young, you're not surfing yet. It's like the waves are, what's going on? Can you describe it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, definitely not surfing. And my version of jumping waves is probably pretty lame compared to any sort of real explorer. But I was with my brother, little brother, and we would go out, you know, where it felt a little dangerous for us, but where I'm sure it was still safe according to our parents. And we would, you know, as the waves came in, we would sort of hop up and sometimes they would crash right on us, but, you know, we could swim, so it was okay. But we would hop over each wave as they came in. And there's something really just kind of serene and magical about the ocean. It's this powerful force sort of beyond what any human could do on their own. And there's something really, really cool about that.
So it's you and your brother. Are your parents watching, or is it just you two by yourself?
I think our parents, in my memory, my parents may have been closer than I remembered. But in my memory, it's just the two of us with my parents watching. Yeah.
What was the sensory experience? Can you describe what you, I don't know, felt or heard or tasted or touched or saw?
Sure. this is fun and interesting. It was, well, salty because the ocean was salty. And sort of like when the waves were calm, it was more peaceful. But as the waves came and on days where they were less calm, it was more, I mean, rough is kind of a negative word, but it was more exciting and more adventurous.
Yeah, you were getting into the emotions of it as well. Yeah, it's, so you said it was like the ocean is really powerful. It's, I mean, I heard excitement. Can you name some of the emotions that you felt?
Yeah, totally. Exhilaration and excitement. But also when the waves were calmer, it was more like peacefulness and serenity and calm. So it was that sort of juxtaposition of those seemingly opposite emotions that made it so interesting.
I didn't think of that, I don't know if juxtaposition is the right word, but the contrast.
Right. The contrast between calm and serene and peaceful on the one hand, and then like exhilarating and exciting and sort of powerful and all consuming in the other hand. Like there's something about, I mean, it's a little scary, right? As a kid too, but there's something about the sheer majestic power of a wave that's really awe-inspiring for a kid and even maybe for an adult, right? It's like, no one is stopping that wave, right? It's so forceful and so powerful and so majestic.
So based on these feelings, exhilaration, excitement on the one hand, peace, serenity, calm on the other, that the awe, I invite you to think of something that you could do to manifest those emotions, not exactly like you feel in the ocean because nothing is exactly the same, but to get what nature gives you in your day-to-day life, you know, not to get exactly those feelings, but if you could think of something to feel what nature gives you with what you got around you. And there's a couple constraints that have come through experience, something that you're not already doing, something that you do yourself. So it's not that you delegate, because you're going to learn from this experience. And something that the point is not to fix anything, but to leave the world better than you found it in some way. And I want to clarify, a lot of people hear something that I'm not saying. I'm not saying what's something you can do to fix the environment. This is not to fix it. This is really to give you feelings that I read that you value. And
yeah.
A lot of people answer and they're like, oh, you know, I've been meaning to do this thing for a while. Here's what I'm going to do. That's rare. I mean, it happens and it's great when it does. A lot of people, it takes a little while going back and forth because they're so used to like, well, here's 10 little things you can do for the environment. They get stuck in that mindset. But it's really to, you know, to bring yourself some exhilaration and excitement or peace and serenity or something like that. Want to give it a shot?
Yes, I do. So I'm going to see if I can combine two things here, one of which admittedly I did briefly, but it was great. And the challenge for me is the seeming lack of efficiency. So I'll describe this in a moment, but maybe you can help me get over the lack of efficiency, or maybe I can. Well, so what I'm thinking about is going on walks. So I did this very briefly, where I would go on walks and not take my phone. And so just really focus on nature and the birds and the trees and the wind and the weather and the squirrels, and just focus on my environment and my surroundings and appreciating the little things, if you will, without like the distractions of my phone and work and whatnot. So I'd like to do that again. And I'm, you know, I think to the point, perhaps, unless I'm missing it, but to the point of the exercise with respect to positively impacting the environment, I might combine that with, so admittedly, the walk previously was essentially through my neighborhood and to Dunkin' Donuts, where I would buy an extra large styrofoam cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee, which, while very tasty, is probably not making a positive impact on the environment. And so might I suggest replacing that with brewing my own cup of coffee and actually taking that cup of coffee on that walk? So that is something that I've never once done, but that might make for a great experience.
Well, it sounds like I'm running through the checklist in my head, and it's something that you have done, but you weren't going to do before this call. So it's new. It's something you're doing yourself, not delegating. And it sounds like if you were going to go to, and before we went on, he showed me he had a Dunkin' Donuts cup there. And he was like, Josh, I don't want to show this, or I do want to show this. And so I really, by the way, thank you for sharing what a lot of people don't share. And that makes it easier for others. But that's getting aside from you and me or this. So it sounds like it meets all the criteria, and it would take that walk be something that would get you something in the direction of the wave jumping.
I think so. I mean, I think part of it is being open to feeling those feelings from the wind and from the things that nature has to offer me, even if it's not precisely the same as wave jumping. In defense of it being a new experience, I have never once taken a cup of homemade brewed coffee with me on a walk. Never once. So that would be entirely new. And in as much as I'm replacing the styrofoam cup with a mug of homebrewed coffee, it does feel better for the environment. But the sensations of nature, that would be, again, that's something that I did experience in the past and I would love to return to. It's a little scary for the scary part for me, again, is sort of taking that 15, 20 minutes that could be otherwise used for delegating work and catching up on emails, et cetera, for experiencing precisely this. But on the other hand, it would be great to feel those feelings that I felt or that I once felt in the ocean as well.
I'm going to say something that I've had a lot of experience with people concerned about, like, I don't have time for the environment. And I don't want to lead the witness, but a lot of them come back and say, it wasn't that I didn't have time for the environment. It's by not spending time in the environment, my priorities messed up and I was doing lots of knickknack stuff. And they actually find they have more time after they do these things in a way that they never could have anticipated. So I'm interested in how the second conversation, I don't want to take for granted. Would you be willing to come back and share the experience?
Sure.
So how many times would you have to go for a walk over how long a period that, you know, if we schedule a second conversation, if I ask, how did it go, you have a meaningful answer?
Yes, good question. Wow, you're really getting into some SMART goals
exactly.
Here. I like that.
SMART goal, yes.
I mean, hard to say, but I'm perhaps three per week for 6 weeks. So 18 walks over 6 weeks.
So after we stop recording, could we set up on the calendar a time in roughly 6 weeks to hear how it went?
Sounds good.
So that's the first part. The second part is you doing it. And I can't help but think that a lot of people, especially with leadership backgrounds, they both answer and participate, and there's this meta observing what's going on. I wonder if you were doing that and like thinking, what's going on here?
Yes. Yes, I think I'm doing both. And I'm cautious about overcommitting, but I also am up for the challenge and accountability in its broadest form is massively valuable. So, and I'm sure I wrote about that in this book. I've written about it probably in all my books. So to the extent that I'm accountable to myself and to you and to your listeners, that's really quite a, if scary, nonetheless, quite a good thing.
It's a different experience than most interactions on sustainability, isn't it?
Yes, very different. And I appreciate it for one that's not, you know, that's, I'm, again, I think I probably outed myself to you as quite a sustainability newbie with my styrofoam Dunkin' Donuts cup. And, you know, but I'm willing to and interested to learn and grow. And I appreciate a method that's less preachy and more open and more accepting of me where I'm at.
I'll be very interested to hear more of how it goes, you know, actually the experience when we talk next.
Sounds like a plan.
Is there anything I didn't think to ask to this worth bringing up?
My favorite question. No. I mean, there's lots of things, but I think...
Oh, I have to indulge myself. You said please. You can't change a light bulb.
This is real. And funny, my last podcast interview said that that was one of the funniest. She actually said she laughed out loud. But it is true. And I am, one thing I'm good at knowing what I'm good at and what I'm not. And I'm not, I wasn't given the gift of physical labor. And I do seem to electrocute myself or break glasses every time I try to change a light bulb. So I have learned to delegate such work.
Was that a conscious decision to share something vulnerable, or was it just something you share all the time? Because it was definitely an engaging thing to read.
Well, it's a little embarrassing, but I do think that vulnerability brings us closer to our readers. And so I do try to be a super real and authentically vulnerable, even if it's embarrassing. And of course, I was looking for examples of things that I can't do, because those are perfect examples of things that we can delegate, right? And something so simple as changing a light bulb. My friend Tony, who changes my light bulbs, he will appreciate the shout out. So Tony, thanks for all the great work that you did.
I mean, to me, that's a great place to end, because it's really bearing something, not your soul, but I mean, part of it. But yeah, it was really engaging. So Dave Kirpin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh.
How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.